I have on the telephone with me right now, as we speak, our senator from the 14th Legislative District, Curtis King. Good morning. How are you doing today?
We're doing very well for a Monday morning. I'm not ready to complain, and thank you for the opportunity to be with you this morning.
Yeah, things are moving right along during the legislature, right?
Oh, yes, they are. I mean, we're starting week six out of a scheduled 15-week session, so it's hard to believe that we've been here five weeks already. But time flies when you're having fun or you're really busy, either way. So
things are still in committee at this point, aren't they?
They are. This is the last week for us to hear Senate bills in committee. They have to be what we call exec'd or moved out of that committee by Friday. An example, we're meeting today in Labor and Commerce. We're looking at execing about 8 bills. I think tomorrow we meet, and we're looking at execing probably 7 or 8, maybe as many as 10 bills. And then on Thursday we meet, and right now I think we have 7 or 8 bills to try and move out of committee, just as an example. But all committees are doing that unless they're a fiscal committee. So transportation has their own, budget.
Well, they do.
So they will hear bills for another week. So they give them one more week if you're a fiscal committee, which basically would be the operating budget and transportation.
So you serve on transportation. You also serve on labor. What committees do you all serve on?
I'm the ranking member on transportation, the ranking member on labor and commerce. I sit on the rules committee. Those are my three committees that I serve on.
Okay. All right. So you've seen a lot of action going on, and it looks like almost halfway through the session, right?
Getting pretty close. It's so good to be back in person.
Yeah,
and to be in committee in person and to be on the floor, there is no comparison to be back where things are somewhat normal compared to the last 2 years where everything, for the most part, was done by Zoom. It is a much different atmosphere, much different climate, and I think a more positive climate because people have to work with each other. It's a lot easier to look at somebody on a screen and say no than it is to look them in the eye and say no.
Yeah.
I find it, this is the way government should be run. So.
And you know, when you do things on Zoom, if you're not happy with something, you can just turn your screen off, turn your camera off, and, you know, just go ahead and do whatever you do. But you're dealing with people directly, and I think that is the more positive way to get things done.
Well, it is. I mean, and that doesn't mean you always have to agree, but
right. But
at least you can sit across the table from each other or sit in committee and have a conversation about a bill that you may like or dislike, talk about what kind of changes you may want to make and why. All those things are really hard to do when you're on Zoom. You just don't have the opportunity. As an example, Friday before last, I was working on a bill that I wanted to put together, and it involved a couple of members of the House, so I went over, set up a time, and went over and met with both of them, talked about the bills, told them what I wanted to do. They were in agreement, it's difficult, very difficult to do that when you're not meeting in person.
Would you say most of the committee stuff that you're dealing with now is partisan, or are you getting a lot of bipartisan support either way?
Well, usually most of the legislation, and I'll say 90% of it, is usually somewhat bipartisan.
Okay, right.
We have those bills that one side or the other doesn't like or can't agree to. We are, as you know, not in the majority. So, our challenges are bigger than if we were. So we just have to work with the other side of the aisle and try to see where we can find agreement. And I would say that this year I'm finding that they're much more willing to have the conversation to consider changing some bills and at least look at it and talk. That's the encouraging part about this year.
Any specific bills in labor and commerce or in transportation you'd like to specifically talk about?
Oh, we have, I'll talk about one. There's a real emphasis this year on safety and transportation.
Okay.
We had 745 people die on our highways last year, which is, I think, the highest, the highest that we've ever had. And so we're looking at safety things. I was serving on a task force this interim, along with my chair, Senator Leas, in transportation, about how do we take care of our highway workers and protect them. We have lost two or three or four highway workers that where there's a project going on, and these people are working, yet they're trying to keep the highway open and moving. I was honored to be on that committee. We have a bill that I think is going to go that would allow to put cameras in those work areas so that we could make sure people are slowing down and paying attention. The state patrol normally can have a car sitting there with a state patrolman or woman in it. But they are so shorthanded these days. They're down like 178 troopers. So that's difficult for them to do. So we got to do something to make sure these highway workers can get home safely at night like the rest of us. And we're not, the Republicans usually aren't big proponents of cameras, but in this case, we think it's the equitable thing to do and the best way to keep these people safe. And so that bill's moving forward, and it's about trying to protect those workers.
Can I ask a question on that? I've noticed that some of the projects more recently, they have fewer flaggers to direct traffic than before.
Well, all of those factors. They're like every other business. These contractors are like everybody else. They're struggling to find enough employees.
Okay. Yeah.
But we got to make sure that things are identified correctly, that people know what they're supposed to do. But particularly, get off your phone. Pay attention, because there's people working in some cases 5-6 feet away from where you're driving. Now, usually there's a barrier there, but still, we've had people drive right into the middle of a work area. We've had, a lady that was hit. Now, she survived. She's out of the hospital, but she'll never be the same. And so we gotta do what we can to make sure these people get home safe. That's what we're trying to do here.
Yeah, and there's an emphasis nowadays on getting away from people who are in a position where their cars are driving themselves, and that's a very dangerous situation.
It is. It's an interesting proposition. I think I've been told that there are two states already that have autonomous vehicles going around, it's one of those things that I would say is coming. We're going to have to get used to it. When you look over and you don't see anybody driving the car, it's kind of disconcerting, to say the least.
Mm-hmm.
But they want to tell us that their track record is pretty clean.
Mm-hmm.
We're being very cautious here in the state of Washington about how we move forward with autonomous vehicles. So all of those factors have to be looked at. Who's responsible? Are they really safe? And where's a reasonable place to use them and not use them? And so we got a long way to go before I think we really open up that opportunity.
Yeah, and these newer cars, you know, you can put them on cruise and they drive themselves. And people just start playing on their phones. I'm free to do other things, and that's really a problem.
Well, it is a problem. I would tell you that I think speed is a problem. I'm not exactly known for being the slowest car on the road.
Yeah, put your conscience.
But I can tell you, I drive back and forth from Olympia to Yakima. I try to get home on the weekends if I can.
Mm-hmm.
But every weekend I come back on Sunday afternoon, and usually across Snoqualmie Pass. And yesterday was no exception. And I'm driving along, probably doing more than I should. But I had two or three cars weaving in and out of traffic and going by me. I mean, seriously, they had to be doing 90 to 100 miles an hour.
Yeah. Yeah,
and it isn't just one. It's two or three or four every mm-hmm. trip I make.
Yeah.
And then they're in such a hurry. I was one of them got behind a car. And then wanted to pull over, and he pulled over right in front of me. He was probably 5 or 6 feet from the car in front of him, and he was probably only five or six feet from me.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the kind of, because they don't think they're going to get caught. And
yeah.
Again, it goes back to our lack of state patrolmen, and I know that the chief Batiste is working hard to try and fill that gap. But it's hard to do with all of the bills and laws that we've passed the last couple of years that just go after our police officers.
And that's affecting the State Patrol and also the DOT, isn't it?
It's affecting every law enforcement organization, from sheriffs to city police. They're all hurting because we've defunded. We've taken away a lot of their tools to actually go after an arrest.
Mm-hmm.
We can't pursue. We got a law that said if you didn't see the incident, you cannot pursue somebody. We can't arrest anybody if they're found to have drugs on their possession.
Exactly.
All we can do is say, we have a program here. Here, take this. If you want to get off, please do that. I read a statistic yesterday. I don't know where it came from, but in the state of Washington, they were talking about they had, and I think it was a sheriff in one of the counties, that they had talked to 400 and some individuals that were found to have drugs on them, and they made that offer to them. They had one person take them up on it.
So,
instead of arresting them, giving them a judge a chance to say, you got to turn your life around, you got to go and get cleaned up, we just let them go. And that's another reason why you see overdose deaths in the highest it's been, I think, in our state history as well.
And that includes fentanyl.
Oh, fentanyl is a killer like nobody else.
Exactly, yeah.
The problem with fentanyl is, If you're a user, and you build up, you use more and more all the time. And I've had a couple of instances that I've heard about where individuals have finally said enough is enough, and they've gotten themselves sober. And after a few months, they go to a party or something, and somebody offers, and they go right back. But they go back to the level where they left.
Okay.
And their body isn't used to that, and that's what kills them. Because they built up this, I won't call it an immunity, but they built up this resistance, and they need more and more. But then when they go back, it's just too much of a shock on their body.
Yeah, and think of all the thousands of children who are getting into disguised and candy and all kinds of things.
Well, we have a couple of bills. In fact, I think we're going to exec one of them today that goes after some of these candies that have THC in them.
Okay.
and that that are now appearing. They come out of hemp, and they take the THC, and I'm no expert on this, believe me, but and they make these little candies out of them. We've had a couple of instances in another state where, you know, children got a hold of their father's little gummies and thought they were candy, and they ended up in the hospital. I mean, it's just a scary proposition, let alone the fact that they're showing up now in an unregulated market and in some of these convenience stores, and anybody can buy them. And so you can imagine high school kids and those kinds of things that are looking for a high. We're just, we got to do something about it. We're trying to do it this year. So.
Very good. Well, that's very good. So what's happening on the labor industry? What's going on there you'd like to talk about?
Oh, we have a variety of things. There's always a railroad bill that goes after the railroad in some way that they're treating their employees. Although I would tell you that these employees, right, wrong, or indifferent, are very well paid. They have what are called platinum benefits. But you know, every year we do something, and then we wonder why Burlington Northern or UP isn't jumping all over the place to do something for the state of Washington.
Mm-hmm.
We have a program called paid family and medical leave that was underwater at the end of last year, or at the end of session last year. We bailed it out, I was served on a task force, which was probably really one of the best task force I've ever served on. But we listened to everybody's arguments and points of view, and we kept working and working, and we found, I think, a very good solution to how we can fund this, how we can maintain it, and make sure that it's solvent, because it's a program that is highly used. It's the law, whether you like it or not, but it's the law. So I think that bill is progressing through the legislature. So we have some positive things that are happening. I think we also have a program called long-term care, which is a nightmare, and we got to do something to straighten it out. I haven't heard of much in the way of legislation this session, but it's supposed to go into effect in July, so we better get on our high horse here and figure out what we're doing, because the way it's set up right now, I just don't see how it's going to work and how it's going to be successful, and it's going to be very costly. So paid family and medical leave is going to take, got to think about this, 0.8%, so just a little less than 1% of your paycheck will go into paid family and medical leave. If we implement long-term care, right now it's at 0.58 of a percent will come at it. But I firmly believe that within a year, it'll be closer to 1%. So now we have two programs that will automatically take almost 2% of your check every month or every week to pay for these programs, which are programs that you may or may not ever use.
Exactly.
And the long-term care one has minimal benefit. It's not portable, so you can pay into it all your life. And then your kids live in Arizona, and they said, "Mom, Dad, come down and live with us." And so you move down there, and you give up everything that you earned in that program. But it only pays for $36,500 of long-term care. Well, you know, if you're lucky, that maybe is 4 or 5 months in a care facility. It just needs a lot of work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I understand. So, transportation, I want to stay with the labor and commerce for just a moment.
Sure.
So, Are there any, there's been a lot of talk about raising taxes and not letting voters decide or have any input on how these are being dealt with.
We have, there was a bill, and I believe we passed it off the Senate floor last Thursday or Wednesday that had to do with, and I shouldn't say we, because I think every Republican voted against it. But it basically eliminated the advisory votes that appear on your ballot.
Right.
That have to do with the taxes that are increased or decreased every year. If there's a change in a tax, you get an advisory vote. The other side of the aisle wants to eliminate it. They say there's better ways to provide that information. They say that, you know, we never pay any attention to those votes. But from my standpoint, in an election year where those votes appear on the ballot, that's probably one of the biggest things I get calls about is what are these advisory votes? There are those that have done their homework and they call me and go, well, why did you vote for that, or why did you vote against that? And it's good that we're able to have those discussions, because I like people to know why I took a vote that I took, and if I can't justify it, then I should have voted differently.
Right.
And so I think it's good. Does it do much? I think what it does is informs our electorate and gives them an opportunity to say, we don't want any more taxes, or we like that one, or we don't like that one.
And I've heard that some of these discussions on these advisory bills got pretty heated last week or so.
Oh, yeah. The senator that sponsored the bill that we voted on, and like I say, voted on and sent it over to the House, he gave a floor speech. You would have thought we were talking about hanging people. I mean, it was an amazing speech in regards to how passionate she got about these advisory votes. And we're all sitting there going, what the hey? It's an advisory vote. It's not mayhem.
Right.
But anyway.
And getting back to transportation, I know last time we talked, there's been some bills to fund some of the highway and bridge projects.
Well, the governor and his transportation budget that he put for us, which he has to by law, moved a huge number of projects out six years, some even 10 or 12 years.
Oh.
To fund some other things that he had, looking at, you know, what all of these projects, the amount of money they added up to and when they were going to be needed. But it was basically to do with the cash flow and what he wanted to spend money on versus these projects that had already been aged and phased and voted on. And he just moved them out. So we are working diligently on the transportation budget, which will include those projects. And we're looking at moving them back up in the time frame, trying to see how we can do that and coordinate it with DOT so that they have the ability to actually implement those projects and get them going and get them done. From my standpoint, I think there's been somewhat of a reluctancy on DOT to do some of these projects, but we'll see how it plays out. But there are a lot of very unhappy people on both sides of the aisle.
Mm-hmm.
The prime example of that is the North-South Freeway in Spokane. That project was started in 1970, somewhere in that vicinity.
Oh, my. Wow.
The first floating bridge on the 520 floating bridge in Seattle was started and built, and now we've replaced it. So we've built two 520 bridges, and we still haven't finished the North-South Freeway.
Mm-hmm.
So the governor moved that out 6 years. So, mm-hmm. I mean, it's like, how can you do that? And these, you got projects that are being worked on, and they're going to have to stop and wait, and all that does is totally increase the cost of what these projects are gonna ultimately cost us.
And it does seem like many times the east side of the state really gets a lower treatment preference as opposed to the west side getting things accomplished.
Well, the difference here is that on the east side, our projects are usually smaller in cost. I would tell you, I know that a few years back we looked at the amount of money that I'm going to use Klickitat County, how much money they paid in when you looked at the taxes, that the transportation taxes I'm talking about that were collected, versus the amount of project money that was put back into the county. And they were, and I'm pulling this number off the top of my head, but it seemed like they were getting $1.27 for every dollar that they were paying out.
Mm-hmm.
So the difference is you do a project over here, or you do a project like the bridge across the Columbia at Vancouver. I mean, that now is approaching somewhere between $5.5 and $7.5 billion.
Really?
That's the challenge that we have. Most of the projects over here are at least $1 billion. The 405, those, you know, can run up to $2 billion. So that's the difference. But for the most part, I would say we try to make sure that the counties on the east side get back what they pay in. The difference is just the scale of the projects and all of those types of things.
Yeah, I can see that, because we are smaller in size and population and actually money that counties can actually contribute. So I appreciate that.
No, I would, you know, and you build a mile of road in Yakima County or in Klickitat County or Benton County, I can guarantee you it's a lot cheaper than building a mile of road in King County.
There you go.
You know, so all of those factors come into play. But for the most part, I think the east side does okay.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to make people aware of that, I think. So.
And I know there was talks about some of these projects, including some of the road work in the gorge, right?
Oh, yes. We're working diligently on trying to find more funding for the Hood River Bridge.
Right.
We're working to make sure that we get the underpass in Bingen taken care of, as well as working on the railroad crossings at Walnut Street and Maple, trying to maintain those and get them brought up to a level where the cities of White Salmon and Bingen can apply for a quiet zone.
Mm-hmm.
So that the trains don't have to blow their whistle every time they come through there. A variety of those kinds of things. So.
Did Washington DOT have much to do with replacing the Dalles Bridge across 197? That's been a long-going project.
Honestly, I don't know. I have not heard of Washington being involved with that project, but so I don't really know.
Because we see mostly Oregon crews working on that.
Well, and it may be. I know
okay.
that, like, the Hood Bridge is owned by the Port of Hood River.
Okay.
I don't know who owns or operates the Dalles Bridge.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll be glad to check into that, if you like.
All right. Well, I would like to. Well, thank you so much for being with us and taking a few moments to talk about what you guys are doing there in the Senate. I appreciate that very much.
Well, the pleasure is always mine, and I'll look forward to doing this again in the future. So thank you for the opportunity.